speaker today, if you want to buy the books, they are on sale, we're happy to sign them for you. And our speaker today is Ben McIntyre, who all of you will really know, I don't need to introduce him. He's a columnist and associate editor on The Times. He's worked on that newspaper as a correspondent in New York, Paris and Washington. He has written many books, and most of them turned out to be massive bestsellers. They include Agent Zigzag, The Spy Among Friends, Operation Mincemeat, Double Cross, and SAS Rogue Heroes. He regularly presents a BBC series on these books. His most recent book, the subject of today, The Spy and the Traitor, The Greatest Espionage Story of the Cold War, was published in September earlier this year. As I say, we have the book on sale. If you want to buy it, I'm sure you'll sign it. But without more ado, I need to ask Ben McIntyre.
Thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Thank you very much for having me. It's a very slightly daunting audience, this. Not just because of distinguished attendees, but because some people in this audience know a great deal more about this story than I do. You can probably work them out for yourselves. I'm certainly not going to have them here, but without them, it would have been impossible to write this book. It's been a very different book for me, this. I've never written a book before about somebody who is alive, very much alive. And that had its own peculiar difficulties in some ways. But without the help of the people who actually took part in the operation, I could never have even started to write it. I first met Oleg Gordievsky nearly 5 years ago now. This is a photograph of him in the safe house where he has lived for most of the last 3 decades. It's a very strange life that Oleg Gordievsky lives. In many ways, he's a sort of captive of history, particularly since the events of last March in Salisbury. He doesn't go out alone. He is under very, very tight security. And he lives a fairly solitary life. He's much visited by his old friends from the service, but nonetheless, he's really a sort of lonely figure in some ways. I first began to interview him, as I say, about 5 years ago, and as the project accelerated, there was a period when I was going there roughly once a month. Among Oleg's many qualities is an absolutely prodigious memory. Until very recently, he was able not just to tell you what had happened 35 years ago, but to give you a very vivid sense of what it felt like. And for a non-fiction, narrative non-fiction writer, that is gold dust. Spies on the whole, and this is a fairly controversial statement to say, given who I know are in this audience, intelligence doesn't always make a huge amount of difference. It can oil the wheels of traditional diplomacy, it can make us all safer. When it goes wrong, it can make us markedly more unsafe, but it doesn't often or usually change strategic thinking in government. There are exceptions, and Oleg Gordievsky, it seems to me, is one of those. His intelligence over a long period was of such high quality that it was materially affecting and changing the way that policy was being made in Downing Street and in the Oval Office. That doesn't happen very often. And it's particularly odd, in a way, given where Oleg came from. Oleg was a very unlikely spy for the West. He was brought up in the KGB. His father was a KGB officer, so enthusiastic that he wore his uniform at weekends, as you see here. Oleg was brought up in the family of the KGB. He ate KGB food, he lived in a KGB compound. Really, he never considered being anything other than a KGB officer. This is another photograph of his father, Anton Gordievsky, who was a long-term, utterly dedicated, completely unquestioning servant of the communist regime. Oleg himself would refer to him as Homo Sovieticus. And a rebellion against his father is part of the story of Oleg's development, but it's not all of it. Oleg was a very talented student. He graduated with extremely good marks, and so he proved himself to be really a supremely good linguist. He learnt German fluently. He then went on to learn other European languages, including English. He attended the prestigious Moscow Institute of International Relations, often referred to as the Harvard of Russia. There he, again, excelled. One of the things about being at that institute was that you had access to Western newspapers. So, with some discretion, you could read up about what was really happening in the West. And I suspect that was really one of the earliest moments when Early began to sort of question the propaganda with which he'd been raised. The reason I show you this photograph is that Oleg also took up long-distance running. And in a way, I think the sort of motif of long-distance running is one of the ways to try to understand Gordievsky, because I think the loneliness of the long-distance runner is sort of part of what informed him. The decisions that Oleg would take over the course of his double life, really, were ones that he took alone. He didn't really need to refer to other people. He had a strong sense of his own, and he still does, of his own moral rectitude, of a kind of clear path. And that was done very much on his own. More practically, while he was in the running team, he met a man who played an important part. That's over there on the left, you see. But this man, Stanislas Kaplan, who was a Czech trainee intelligence officer, became a very close friend of Oleg. And while Stanislas was not a dissident in any sense of the word, he was a questioner. And he and Oleg began to have long, intense discussions late at night where they began to discuss the future of communism and the nature of the regime. And I think this is also, I mean, Stanislas will play an important part in what happens subsequently. But it was, again, the beginnings of a kind of questioning by Oleg. Another pivotal moment came when he was still at the Institute, when he was sent to East Germany to work as a translator, effectively. He'd already been pretty much tapped up by the KGB. His brother was already inside the KGB, so was his father. There was an office in the Institute that was dedicated to recruiting KGB officers. But the day after he arrived in East Berlin, he was staying in Karlshorst in the KGB enclave there. He looked out the window and saw hundreds of bulldozers and thousands of East German military coming in to build the Berlin Wall. And that was one of the key turning points for Oleg. It was a sort of symbolic moment when he realised, or began to realise, that the regime he was serving was not what it appeared to be. Of course, East Germans referred to the Berlin Wall as the anti-fascist protection wall. Everybody with a brain, and Oleg had a considerable brain, knew that in fact it was a prison wall. It was there to keep the East Germans inside and stop them fleeing to the West, which they were doing in ever-increasing numbers. So you see the beginnings of a sort of disillusionment beginning to kick in here. It didn't, however, stop Oleg from joining the KGB. We think of the KGB as being a vast, monolithic machinery of repression, which it was, but it was also an elite. And joining the KGB was to join an elite force. In fact, it was Kim Philby who said years ago, long before this happened in the 1930s, you do not hesitate to join an elite force. Oleg was trained in the Red Banner Institute, also known as School 101, which I've always rather liked, which was the spy school outside Moscow. There he was introduced to all the complex techniques and methods of Soviet espionage. Dead drops, dead letter boxes, and particularly what the Russians refer to as proverka, which literally means sort of dry cleaning. And that is surveillance and surveillance evasion. Oleg turned out to be extremely good at evading surveillance. He's a champion dry cleaner. And that also plays an important part in what follows. This is the Lubyanka, the rather beautiful and very sinister headquarters of Russian and Soviet intelligence. Oleg began work on the fifth floor, where he was in Directorate S. And now, Directorate S implanted illegals around the globe. Those are what we would call them knocks in British intelligence parlance. They are posing as civilians. They are under deep cover. They usually have false identities. And Oleg's job, really, was to create people who didn't exist, which he found rather frustrating, in fact, because he wanted to be an illegal himself, like his brother. His brother was already working as an illegal in Western Europe. Oleg's big break came in 1967, when he was sent to Copenhagen as officially as a legal, as a formal member of the Soviet diplomatic staff. In fact, he was running the illegals network. And life in Copenhagen was another extraordinary eye-opener for Oleg. He was absolutely stunned by the freedom, by the fact that he could read any book he wanted, that he could listen to any classical music he liked. Oleg was and is a person of very high culture, and the freedom, the cultural freedom that he experienced in Denmark was astonishing for him, I think. He'd only been there a year when another critical world event took place, which was the crushing of the Prague Spring. This photograph shows a sort of lone demonstrator in the centre of Prague standing against the tanks, which were sent in to crush the liberalising reform movement of Alexander Dubček. Now, Oleg was stunned by this and furious. He almost took it as a sort of personal affront that the Soviet Union had moved in to destroy what he and many other young Russians believed might be the future of the communist regime, a sort of socialism with a human face. And he did something very interesting, in retrospect, probably also quite dangerous and possibly quite foolish, which was that he went to a telephone inside the Soviet embassy that he knew was bugged by Danish intelligence. And he delivered a harangue to his then-wife, chastising, sort of attacking the Soviet Union for what he considered to be a sort of act of barbarism. Now, he did this because he believed that the Danish intelligence would pick it up and that it would be a hint. He wasn't ready yet to come over, but it was a hint that he was not like the other KGB officers. The odd thing about this signal sent to the West was that it was completely mixed. For reasons that I've never been able to work out, the Danes were definitely listening to this telephone, but in the miles and in the acres of transcripts of overheard messages, this little hint was missed. However, they were already on to Oleg. The Danish intelligence service, known as PET, it has a completely unpronounceable Danish name, which I won't attempt, but it's shortened to PET, very small, very efficient, and a close ally of MI6, were already watching Oleg. They already had him flagged as a KGB officer. And these are a set of surveillance photographs that we discovered in Oleg's attic just a few years ago. These are taken long before he was ready to turn over. And they have a sort of grainy quality, which I rather love. That again is Oleg looking rather concerned there. And I think this must have been taken by a fixed camera somewhere on one of the main streets in Copenhagen. So they were keeping a close eye on Oleg. Another critical moment took place when Stanislas Kaplan, the Czech intelligence officer I referred to at the beginning, defected. He defected after the Prague Spring, and he wound up in London, where he was debriefed by MI6. And one of the things he told MI6 was that, routinely when defectors came over to the West, they were asked, who else is there in your experience, who else is there in your acquaintance, who might think in a similar way to you? And Kaplan said, Oleg Gordievsky is someone who is open to other ideas. I don't think he put it much more highly than that. So the combination of Peck keeping an eye on Oleg when he was in Copenhagen and this little hint meant that for the first time Oleg was flagged up in SIS files. He returned to Moscow. He spent 3 years in Moscow. He was then redeployed back to Denmark, where he was now in the political section. So he was attempting to recruit people in Denmark and around Scandinavia who would spy for the Soviet Union. The reason I show you this photograph is that by this point MI6 was watching as well. And a particular MI6 officer, who's identified in the book as Richard Bromhead, approached Oleg on the badminton court where he was known to play every morning, and began to signal that there was a possibility that the business could be done. A very long courtship took place after this evening. He was not reeled in immediately. It took a very long time, and there were hiccups along the way. And in fact, the courtship was so subtle that at one point, Richard Bromhead sent a message to MI6 headquarters saying, help, I think Oleg Gordievsky is trying to recruit me. Eventually, after about a year and a half, a deal was struck. It became clear that Oleg was prepared to start spying for the West. And he began to produce an extraordinary amount of material, really of the highest grade. I think I'm right in saying probably more important than any other agent that probably, these things are always comparative, but this stuff was high grade. What Oleg was doing was he was raiding the diplomatic bag, which every week would bring in microfilm instructions for the KGB, in Copenhagen. He would extract the microfilm, he would take them to his MI6 contact, who would copy them using a special machine made in Hanslope Park, and then return them to the files. It was extremely dangerous. Had he been caught doing it, he would have been in serious trouble. But a routine developed, and as with quite a lot of intelligence work, it is quite routine. while it was always perilous and always dangerous, it was nonetheless a pattern began to emerge. And some of the material that Oleg was producing was extraordinary. I'll just give you one example. The person you see on the left here is a man called Arne Treholt. Now, in the 1970s, Arne Treholt was a rising star of the Norwegian Labour Party. A lot of people thought he might become the next Prime Minister of Norway. He was very highly thought of, but he was also a long-term KGB agent. The man you see here, nicknamed the Crocodile, is Gennady Titov, who was his case officer. Over a very long period, Arne Treholt had been paid a great deal of money by the KGB. Now, this, of course, the reason I tell you this is that one of the issues with really high-grade intelligence is that if it's really good, you can't necessarily use it. Because had Arne Treholt simply been arrested, that would have tipped off to the KGB that there was somebody in the system that was leaking information. And so instead of simply catching him and winding him up, they watched him. Which is also what intelligence services do on this side as well. And again, that will play an important part as we move on. Towards the end of his time in Copenhagen, Oleg fell in love with Leyla Aliyev. And now, Leyla was the daughter of very senior KGB officers. She, like Oleg, had come from the KGB family, if you like. Oleg was already married at this point, and in order to divorce his wife and remarry Leyla, he knew there was going to be a problem, because the KGB, while being an almost entirely amoral organisation, was extraordinarily moralistic about things like divorce and adultery and remarriage. And Oleg knew that his career, or sensed that his career, was likely to go through a major dip when this happened. So before leaving Copenhagen, one of his last meetings, I think it was probably about a year actually before he left Copenhagen, he said to his MI6 case officer, "I need an escape plan. I need some way to get out of Moscow if I get into trouble." Now, this was an extremely difficult problem because MI6 had never smuggled anybody out of the Soviet Union, let alone a KGB officer, let alone a KGB officer who was likely, if he was in trouble, to be under close KGB surveillance. The job of attempting to work out a way to get Gordievsky out fell to an extremely talented woman officer in MI6 who, over a long period, worked out that there was one potential way to get somebody out of the Soviet Union. And that was by using diplomatic immunity. By convention, not law, but by convention, diplomatic cars crossing borders are not searched. Now, this convention was routinely violated by Soviet border guards. If they suspected there was any reason to search a car, they would simply do it anyway. But it was possible, she worked out, that if Oleg could be got to a particular rendezvous point south of the Finnish border, if he could throw off surveillance for long enough, and if MI6 could drive a car or cars up to that point with diplomatic plates, they might be able to get him into the boot. They might be able to wrap him in a special heat-reflective blanket that would prevent the infrared cameras from picking him up as he went across the border. And they might be able to smuggle him across the border into Finland, where he might still get away, so long as the Finns didn't realise he was there. So they'd have to get him up the Norwegian border and then get him out that way. There are a lot of conditionals in this, because it was extremely unlikely to work. It was codenamed Operation Pimlico. And obviously, in order to activate Operation Pimlico, there had to be a signal. Oleg had to be able to tell MI6 in Moscow that he needed to get out. And the signal for Operation Pimlico, unbelievably, went like this. If Oleg was seen on a particular corner of a particular street on Kutuzovsky Prospect, outside a bread shop here. Now, the reason why this was chosen was because the MI6 flats were here. This is a diplomatic compound used also by journalists as well. It was sort of the main Western compound. If he was seen standing there at 7:30 on a Tuesday night holding a Safeway bag with a big red S on it, that would be the signal that he needed to get out. The acceptance signal that MI6 had seen him was that an MI6 officer would walk towards him holding a Harrods bag and eating a Mars bar. Or a Kit Kat. It had to be one or the other. It had to be a British Mars bar. And actually, the Safeway bag, which sounds completely bonkers in some ways, was actually quite clever because Oleg was known to have been in the West. Western carrier bags, plastic bags, were prized in Soviet Union, and it would stand out. It would stand out as distinctive, but not illogical for Oleg to be holding such a thing. Ditto, I suppose, the idea of a British diplomat, apparently a diplomat, holding a Harrods bag would not be so odd either. The odd thing about, the extraordinary thing about Operation Pimlico is that for 7 years, this signal site was policed. It was watched every Tuesday night. In fact, one of the officers involved told me that they ate so many Kit Kats that by the end of the posting they just couldn't face another one. Oleg returned to Moscow from Copenhagen under instructions that he was to try to get himself into the British section, because then, of course, he would have access to what Britain, what MI6 regarded as the crown jewels, and then with luck he might get himself redeployed to London. I realise I'm running out of time, so I'll quickly run through what happened then. He was indeed redeployed to London. Before going, he went through the British archive in the KGB headquarters. Everything that Britain, that the Soviets had been aiming to do in Britain over the previous period. And some of what he discovered was extraordinary, including evidence that Jack Jones, the great TUC leader, had for many years been a highly paid Soviet agent codenamed Drim. But the most important file that he came across was identified as Agent Boot. Agent Boot was Michael Foote. I love the idea of Major Petrov drawing up this file for the first time and thinking, his name is Foote, we will call him Boot. Very funny British joke. What the Boot files revealed was that for a very long period, from 1949 until 1968, Michael Foote had many meetings with the KGB, not just one or two, but dozens. He had also been paid a considerable amount of money, the equivalent today of about £37,500. Now, what was Michael Foote? Well, he wasn't a spy, because he didn't have access to the sort of information that would have classified him as that. What was he doing for the Soviet Union? Well, he was providing useful information, gossip about what was going on inside the Labour Party, evidence about what was happening in the trade union movement. The Soviet Union, these officers, were giving him information that they thought ought to be produced in either journalistic form or in speeches. So what does this make Michael Foote? Well, when we serialised the book in the Times a few months ago, it created an explosion. And on the left, there were people saying, this is disgraceful, a dead man is being smeared who can't fight back. And the right said, this is evidence that he was a traitor. Well, neither of those things is true, because Michael Foote sits somewhere in the middle of that spectrum. There's a very good Russian term which literally translates as useful idiot. And it was coined by Lenin, in fact. And it's usually used to refer to people who are used either advertently or inadvertently for propaganda purposes. Michael Foote was very useful to the Soviet Union, but he was also, I would argue, completely idiotic to have allowed himself to be used in this way. Oleg came to London with his family. He now had two young children and his wife, Leila. They settled into London life. They absolutely loved living here. But all the time, and Leila remained completely ignorant of this, all the time Oleg was producing whatever information was coming into the KGB station and passing it on to MI6. They would meet regularly at the MI6 safe house in Bayswater. And he was producing information of world-changing importance. I'll just quickly give you two examples of this. This is a photograph of a demonstration that took place after the downing of KAL-007, the Korean airliner. This was a time of intense tension between East and West, the early 80s. And one of the things that Oleg produced and presented to MI6 was evidence that the Kremlin genuinely believed the West was planning a first strike. That so far from being the aggressors in some ways, Andropov and his regime genuinely believed that the West was going to pull the trigger. And Operation Rian was an order that went out to all the KGB stations in the West, instructing them to find evidence of a looming first strike. Now, on the whole, if you ask spies and intelligence officers to find something you already believe, that is what they will find. And some of the instructions were ludicrous, including sort of try and find out if blood is being stockpiled in blood banks because there's about to be a nuclear attack. I think the Soviets still were under the impression that blood banks were actually banks that had a, you know, where the price went up and down depending on supply. But actually, this was materially important. I mean, when this information landed on Ronald Reagan's desk, it actually materially changed the rhetoric. All the stuff, not all the stuff, but they began to tone down the oratory about the evil empire and so on. And you can see a sort of sea change that happens. That's one example. Another one is that when Gorbachev famously came to visit the UK, came and met Thatcher towards the end of 1984, one of the tasks of the KGB, including early, was to produce briefing notes for Gorbachev on what he might say to Thatcher when they met. He was not yet the leader of the Communist Party, but he was clearly the rising star. And so Oleg was one of the key figures who was producing briefing notes for Gorbachev. But of course, those briefing notes were actually dictated by MI6. So you've got a unique situation here where one spy is effectively briefing both sides. He's telling Gorbachev what to say to Thatcher at the same time as he's advising MI6 what Thatcher might like to say to Gorbachev. And so when Thatcher emerged from those meetings saying, "Here is someone we can do business with," that was partly because Gordievsky was rigging the business. Now, I said that the information was landing on Ronald Reagan's desk, and it was obviously getting there from the CIA. In the course of the early 80s, MI6 made a strategic and entirely sensible decision to begin sharing the information it was getting from Gordievsky with the Americans. Now, under convention, and traditionally, you don't have to reveal where this comes from. So, while MI6 was being very generous with its information, it was not revealing where it came from. It was disguising the origin, it was parceling it up. Now, the CIA doesn't really like not to know where the information comes from. It's not a very good look if you're the CIA chief and you're going into the Oval Office and saying, "Mr. President, we have some very good information here, but we don't really know where it comes from." And so the CIA secretly, and without telling MI6, set up its own task force to try to identify who the Brits had, where this information was coming from. And they worked it out. It took them quite a long time. It was in some ways a very clever piece of sleuthing. They worked out where the little gobbets of information were coming from Britain, which officers this might tally with. And eventually they worked it out. They worked out that Gordievsky had to be this sort of agent, this undercover agent. They gave him a code named Tickle, and they simply tucked this piece of information away with some satisfaction, I think. What they didn't know, however, was that the head of the counterintelligence section in the CIA, Aldrich Ames, was about to go over to the KGB. So you have an almost perfect circle here, where the KGB is spying on the CIA, the CIA is secretly investigating MI6, MI6 is spying on the KGB. And so it goes round in a circle. And very soon after, in fact, the day that Aldrich Ames first approached the Soviet, the KGB in Washington and offered to spy from them. Within 24 hours, a cable arrived in Moscow instructing Oleg to return to Moscow to be anointed, effectively, as head of the KGB in London. He'd already been appointed. This was going to be a formal moment. And it triggered an intense debate about whether Oleg should go back or not. And in the end, Oleg, that choice was made by Oleg himself. He was told that he could, with complete honour, down tools, go into retirement, take a new identity and live in Britain for the rest of his life. He himself, and it was an act of staggering bravery, decided that he would fly back to Moscow. The minute he got back to Moscow, he knew he was in deep, deep trouble. He went to his apartment, he opened the top lock, he opened the second lock, but he couldn't open the door because the third lock had been locked. But Gordievsky never had the key to the third lock. In fact, he'd never locked that lock. And that could only mean that the KGB, which had keys to everywhere, had been inside his apartment, accidentally locked all three locks on the way out, thus indicating they'd been inside. And from that moment, he knew he was in real trouble. The person in charge of investigating and catching Oleg in the act was Viktor Budanov, who was head of Section K, which was the KGB's counterintelligence sort of mole-hunting team. Now, it's one of the enigmas of this story is why Budanov didn't simply arrest Gordievsky the minute he arrived back in Moscow. And I think the answer to that is twofold. One, complacency. No one had ever escaped from the Soviet Union. Oleg Gordievsky was going to be under incredibly tight surveillance. So they just didn't believe he could get out. And the second was that, again, it was quite a legalistic organisation, the KGB. Oleg was by now a KGB colonel. You couldn't arrest a KGB colonel and just lock him up. They needed evidence. So they wanted to catch him. It seems pretty clear. They wanted to catch Oleg in flagrante. They wanted to catch him in contact with the MI6 to create an enormous diplomatic firestorm that would then, you know, redound to the Soviet Union's credit. So they watched him. Much in the same way as the West watched the spies that Oleg had identified in Scandinavia, so the KGB put a tail on Oleg and began to watch him. So Oleg knew that he was in deep trouble. He knew that they were onto him, and he now had to make a really difficult decision, and to this day I think it haunts him. He had to decide whether to go alone to activate Operation Pimlico or whether to take his family with him. There was provision in Operation Pimlico for all four members of the family to escape. They would go in two cars. One child and one adult would be secreted in the back, in the boot of each of the cars, and they would try to get them out. So it was potentially doable. Of course, he would have to tell Leyla. He would have to explain to his wife that so far from being a loyal Soviet intelligence officer, he'd been playing for the other side the whole way along. And he decided that he couldn't do it, that he would have to go alone. On the 15th of July 1985, sure enough, he got to the corner, the signal site on Kutuzovsky Prospect. He was just about to leave, in fact, thinking that the signal was not going to be picked up, when a young intelligence officer walked towards him holding a Harris bag and eating a Mars bar. So Operation Pimlico was on. This is one of the escape cars. The plan was, as I said, they had to get to this rendezvous point, about 30 miles south of the Finnish border. Oleg would have to hide himself in a ditch up there, having got there by train and bus and then on foot. The two MI6 cars would come this way. They would also have to throw off KGB surveillance in order to get there. Then they would try and get in there, quickly wrap him in the blanket, and the rest of the family if they were also brought along. And of course, the officers didn't know until the moment that they arrived there whether or not Oleg was going to be on his own or whether he was going to be with the family. Then get him into the car, get him out of here, and then try and get across the border. Now, if you want to know what happened then, you don't have to buy the book. But 4 hours later, beyond the rendezvous moment, on the Saturday after the Tuesday, Oleg Gordievsky was cramped in the boot of a car, sweating, half tranquilized, I think probably sick with fear at this point, not knowing whether he'd got across the border. When he heard a sound, he knew. He heard the strains of Sibelius's Finlandia, played at full volume by the driver of the car to indicate that Oleg was in Finland and he was free. Thank you very much.